He gave away more than 100 free places to poor children. He wished he could have given away more. My mother, meanwhile, started serving a few girls breakfast at our house each day. How can they learn, she said, if their stomachs are empty? One day, I noticed that some of our long-time students had not returned. I asked my father where they were. Oh, Johnny, he said. Some of the richer parents took their children out of school when they found out they were sharing classrooms with the sons and daughters of people who cleaned their houses or washed their clothes. I was young, but I was old enough to feel that wasn't right, and to understand that if too many paying students left, it would mean hard times for the school and for our family. What I didn't know was that a bigger threat was looming, not just for our family and our school, but for all of Pakistan. Chapter 4. A Warning from God. One autumn day, when I was still in primary school, our desks started to tremble and shake. Earthquake! We yelled. We ran outside, some of us falling as we crowded through the narrow door and gathered around our teachers for safety and comfort, like chicks around a mother hen. A few of the girls were crying. We lived in a region where earthquakes happened often, but this felt different. Even after we returned to class, the buildings continued to shake. The rumbling didn't stop. Miss Ulfat, my all-time favorite teacher, told us to stay calm. She assured us that it would soon be over. But when another strong earthquake hit within a few minutes of the first, the students were sent home. When I arrived home, I found my mother sitting in the courtyard where she felt safest because there was no roof above her. She was reciting verses from the Holy Quran as tears streamed down her face. The aftershocks kept coming and continued past nightfall, and every time they did, my mother ran outside and insisted we go with her. My father told her not to upset the children, but we were already upset because the ground was shaking. That earthquake of October 8, 2005 turned out to be one of the worst in history. It was 7.6 on the Richter scale and was felt as far away as Kabul and Delhi. Aftershocks continued for at least a month. Our city of Mingora was largely spared, but the northern areas of Pakistan, including our beloved Shangla, were devastated. When we finally heard from our family and friends there, they said they had thought it was the end of the world. They described the roar of rocks sliding down hills and everyone running out of their houses reciting the Holy Quran, the screams as roofs crashed down, and the howls of buffalo and goats. They were terrified, and then, when the destruction stopped, they waited for help. The government was slow to arrive, but help came immediately from rescue workers from a conservative religious group called Tehreek-e-Nifaz-e-Sharia-e-Mohammadi, TNSM, or the Movement for the Enforcement of Islamic Law, led by Sufi Muhammad and his son-in-law, Maulana Fazlullah. Eventually, the government tried to help, and aid from the Americans, who had troops and helicopters in nearby Afghanistan, made it in. But most of the volunteers and medical help came from organizations that were linked with militant groups like the TNSM. They helped clear and rebuild destroyed villages. They led prayers and buried bodies. They took in many of the 11,000 orphan children. In our culture, orphans are usually adopted by the extended family, but the earthquake had been so bad that entire families had been wiped out or lost everything and were in no position to care for additional children. Many of the orphans went to live in fundamentalist madrasas. Mullahs from the TNSM preached that the earthquake was a warning from God. If we did not mend our ways and introduce Sharia or Islamic law, more severe punishment would come. The whole country was in shock for a long time after the earthquake. We were vulnerable, which made it that much easier for someone with bad intentions to use a nation's fear for his gain. Chapter 5. The First Direct Threat. Each morning, as my friends passed through the gate to school, a man across the street stood scowling at us. Then, one night, he arrived at our home, along with 6 elders from the community. I answered the door. He claimed to be a mufti, or an Islamic scholar, and said he had a problem with the school. My father shooed me into the other room as this mufti and the elders crowded into our little house, but I heard every word. "I am representing good Muslims," the mufti said, "and we all think your girls' high school is a blasphemy. You should close it. Teenage girls should not be going to school. They should be in purdah." This mufti was clearly under the influence of a maulana who had been running an illegal radio broadcast through which he gave sermons and railed against people whom he deemed un-Islamic. What we knew, but the mufti did not, was that his own niece attended my father's school in secret. As my father debated with the mufti, one of the elders spoke up. "I'd heard you were not a pious man," the man said to my father. "But there are Qurans here in your home." "Of course there are," my father said. "I am a Muslim." The mufti jumped back into the conversation, complaining about girls entering the school through the same gate that men also used. So my father came up with a compromise. The older girls would enter through a different gate. Eventually, the mufti backed down and the men left. But even as the door shut behind them, I had a knot in my stomach. I had grown up watching stubborn, prideful Pashtun men. Generally, when a Pashtun man loses an argument, he never really forgets or forgives. Even though I was a child, I knew this man was mistaken. I had studied the Quran, our holy book, since I was 5, and my parents sent me to a madrasa for religious studies in the afternoons when school finished. It was an open-air mosque where boys and girls studied the Holy Quran together. I loved learning the Arabic alphabet. I loved the strange and mysterious shapes of the letters, the sounds of the prayers as we all recited together, and the stories about how to live a life according to the teachings of Allah. My teacher there was a woman. She was kind and wise. For me, the madrasa was a place for religious education only. I would go to the Khushal school for all my other studies. But for many of these children, the madrasa would be the only place they would ever study. They wouldn't take any other classes, no science, no math, no literature. They would study only Arabic so that they could recite the Holy Quran. They didn't learn what the words actually meant, though, only how to say them. I didn't think much of this difference until later, after the mufti's visit to our house. One day I was playing with the neighborhood children in the alley, and when we were choosing up sides for a game of cricket, one of the boys said he didn't want me on his team. "Our school is better than yours," he said, as if that explained things. I didn't agree one bit. "My school is the better one," I said. "Your school is bad," he insisted. "It is not on the straight path of Islam." I didn't know what to make of this, but I knew he was wrong. My school was a heaven. Because inside the Khushal school, we flew on wings of knowledge. In a country where women aren't allowed out in public without a man, we girls traveled far and wide inside the pages of our books. In a land where many women can't read the prices in the markets, we did multiplication. In a place where, as soon as we were teenagers, we'd have to cover our heads and hide ourselves from the boys who'd been our childhood playmates, we ran as free as the wind. We didn't know where our education would take us. All we wanted was a chance to learn in peace. And that is what we did. The crazy world could carry on outside the walls of the Khushal school. Inside, we could be who we were. Our only concerns, once we dropped our school bags in the classroom, were the same as any child's at school. Who would get the highest grade on the day's test, and who would sit with whom at recess? It was a point of pride for me that almost every year in primary school, I won the trophy for first place at the end of the term. I was considered one of the top girls, and the principal's daughter, and some girls thought maybe there was a connection between the two. But it was a point of pride for my father that he gave me no special treatment. And the proof was obvious to everyone when a new girl came to school when I was about 9. Her name was Malka Inur, and she was bright and determined, but I did not think she was nearly as clever as me. So on the last day of school that year, when the awards were announced, I was stunned. She had gotten first place, and I was second. I smiled politely as she received her trophy, but the minute I got home, I burst into tears. When my father saw me, he comforted me, but not in the way I wanted. "It's a good thing to come in second," he said, "because you learn that if you can win, you can lose, and you should learn to be a good loser, not just a good winner." I was too young and too stubborn to appreciate his words, and truth be told, I still prefer to be first. But after that term, I worked extra hard so I would never have to learn that particular lesson again. Another of my regular worries was whether Moniba was angry with me. She was my best friend, bookish like me, almost like my twin. We sat together whenever we could, on the bus, at recess, in the classroom, and she made me laugh as no one else could. But we had a habit of fighting, and always over the same thing, when another girl came between us. "Are you my friend or hers?" Moniba would say, if I sat with another girl at recess. "Moniba," I'd say, "you were the one ignoring me." The worst part was when Moniba would refuse to talk to me. Then I would get angry at her for being so angry at me. Sometimes these spats would last for days. Eventually, I would miss her too much, and I would take responsibility for the fight. I seemed to always take the blame. Then she would make a funny face and we'd fall apart laughing and forget our differences, until the next time another girl came between us. How could a place where I learned so much and laughed so much be bad? Part 2. A Shadow Over Our Valley. Chapter 6. Radio Mulla. I was at the home of one of my relatives in Mingora one evening when I heard a strange sobbing coming from the radio. After a long day of cooking, the women had gathered around the radio as they cleaned up. As usual, I was doing my best to get out of having to do the dishes, but I stopped at the sound of this odd weeping. At first, it sounded like just another imam giving advice about how to live a virtuous life. "Quit smoking," he told the men, "and pray daily." The women murmured in approval, my mother among them. Then he began to cry. "Stop listening to music," he begged. "Stop going to the movies. Stop dancing. Stop," he begged, "or God will send another earthquake to punish us all." Some of the women began to cry. Terrifying memories of the earthquake the previous year were fresh in their minds. Some of them had buried children and husbands and were still grieving. I knew what this radio mullah was saying wasn't true. "An earthquake is a geological event that can be explained by science," I wanted to tell them. But these women, many of whom had no education and were brought up to follow the dictates of their religious leaders, were frightened. As the mullah wept, so did they. Even at school, all that my friends could talk about was the radio mullah, although my father told us not to listen. Our old radio was broken, so I hadn't heard his latest broadcasts, but I heard them at friends' and relatives' houses, and my friends at school repeated his nightly sermons almost word for word. "All music was haram," he said, forbidden by Islam. Only his radio station was permitted. Men should grow their hair and beards long, not keep them short, in what he called the innovative fashion. And women, he said, should stay at home in purdah quarters at all times. They should go out only in emergencies and only wearing a burqa and only with a male relative. At first, my mother had enjoyed his sermons when she listened to them with our relatives, especially when he spoke about the need for daily prayer. People, especially women, romanticized him. People thought he was a good interpreter of the Holy Quran and admired his charisma. They liked his talk of bringing back Islamic law because everyone was frustrated with the slow, corrupt Pakistani justice system. His followers chanted poems that sounded beautiful, but were in fact messages to motivate girls to stop going to school. My father disapproved of him from the beginning. "No radio mullah is going to tell me what to do. This mullah," he declared, "is nonsense and trouble." "Don't speak that way," my mother told him. "God will be angry with you." My father turned out to be right. He had done some investigating of the man behind the mysterious radio voice. "This mullah is a high school dropout. He doesn't even have religious credentials. This so-called mullah is spreading ignorance." The voice on the radio belonged to Maulana Fazlullah, one of the leaders of the TNSM. His followers had helped so many people after the earthquake, but he was taking advantage of the trauma to instill fear in them too. Soon Fazlullah's attacks became personal. He announced the names of men who'd spoken out against him. People we knew, people we didn't know, people who were campaigning for peace in the valley, but also people who thought they were having private conversations. They were all suddenly, publicly, called sinful. It was as if the radio mullah and his men could see through walls. Now that I was getting older, it wasn't so easy to sit in on the men's discussions without being noticed. So I would offer to serve them tea, if only so I could hear what matters they were discussing. In those days, there were only two topics of conversation: the radio mullah and the fighting just across the border in Afghanistan. I was 4 years old when the 9/11 attacks took place, but I'd grown up hearing the name Osama bin Laden. In our country, everyone knows about 9/11 and Osama bin Laden. It was said that he'd planned those attacks not far away in Afghanistan, and for the past several years, the United States and its allies had been fighting a war to find him and to defeat Al-Qaeda and the Taliban government in Afghanistan, which was protecting him. The Taliban. As soon as I would hear that word, my ears would perk up. I'd think back to the conversation I'd had with my father when we were in Changla. The Taliban seemed like something far away then, something bad in a distant place. Many of my father's friends believed that despite how popular Fazlullah was becoming and his association with the Taliban in Pakistan, they were still too far away to be a concern. But he warned them that there would come a day when the Taliban would reach our valley. "They are already in the tribal belt," he said, "and they are coming nearer." Then he quoted a proverb: "Coming events cast their shadows before." Fazlullah moved slowly at first, but in the 2 years that followed the earthquake, he cast a long shadow indeed. I was growing up, and for the first time it occurred to me that our world was changing before my eyes, and not for the better. When I went to bed each night, I had a talk with God. "Please, God, tell me what I can do. I am a small girl, but maybe you have a small job for me." I woke up one day with a plan. I would ignore all this Fazlullah gossip when I got to school. My friends and I should be talking about Bella and Edward or Fruity from the Indian TV show Sunpari. If those topics were off limits for the time being, we could talk about cricket or annoying little brothers, or 100 other things.